When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, my name is Arsene Wenger. You are listening to the Tuesday Club. This is the Arsenal podcast.
Now Bold. And it's Tony Adams put through by Steve Bold. Would you believe it? That sums it all up.
Hello, I'm Alan Davis. You are listening to the Tuesday Club. This is the Arsenal podcast. And I've got Arsene Wenger with me this morning. How are you, Arsene?
I'm well, thank you. I hope you too.
I am very well. It's lovely to see you. Are you at home today?
I'm at home today, yes.
I can see, I'm looking at your background. I can spot a framed shirt, a little trophy there.
That's a framed shot of my 50th birthday.
Oh, wow, wonderful. And a little bit of memorabilia around the place, yeah, mainly red and white.
Yes.
You've joined us today. We're grateful for your time to talk about your autobiography, My Life in Red and White. We're all Arsenal fans on the Tuesday Club, as you may know, so we will obsess, if you don't mind, with those years. But I'm interested, you write quite movingly at the beginning of the book about your childhood and your parents, and you had an older brother who was 5 years older and an older sister who was 10 years older, and a little village with three blacksmiths and dominated by horses. I wonder if it was a quiet place, if it was a still environment that you grew up in.
No, because I grew up in a little bistro, what you call a little pub here, you know. There were always people inside who talked about football, because it was the local headquarters of a football club. And so quite, no, but the rhythm of the village was dominated by religion, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was Christmas, Easter, and all in between the processions. And the priest was the king of the village, you know. And at that time, religion was very dominant. And for the rest, it was an agricultural village, where you could say 90% of people were agricultures, you know, and but it was at the time you had no tractors, it was the horses that were the strong faces in the job on a daily basis. And the physical strength was vital, you know, how hard can you work physically? And that changed in the 60s. But my childhood was straight after the Second World War in 1949. And my grandfather couldn't speak French, but we were French. Mm-hmm. You know, so we spoke Alsatian at home. It's a little dialect that is closer to German than to French. So I learned French at school.
It's interesting. It's always it's an area of France that we learned about here in history books, Alsace and Alsace-Lorraine. Yeah. And your father was caught up in the horror of the Second World War, wasn't he, with the Malgrat Nuit and being turned by the Germans. But you say in the book that he never spoke about that. He never spoke about those times.
No. I couldn't understand why, because he was on the Russian front with the Germans, you know, because at the end of the Second World War, they incorporated by force the territories where they occupied. And so my father from 43 to 45 was a Malgré-nous. That means he was French, but fighting for the Germans against the Russian.
Extraordinary. And your mother left at home with your sister running around quite small and a very small baby boy, your older brother.
Yes.
Did she talk about those times to you?
Not really, you know. I don't know why in Alsace, I think it was must have been a strange period where some, as always, they were not all heroes, you know, and some cooperated with the Germans and some were resistant. And after the Second World War, it was quite a period where people didn't talk about it. They would think, maybe subconsciously, let's not open that book because that would create many problems.
Mm-hmm. They're trying to reintegrate everybody into,
yes,
into life in peacetime and rebuilding the area.
Yeah.
So then you come along in 1949. Mm-hmm. You've got older siblings. Was it quite a lonely childhood in a way for you with older siblings?
That's what my mother told me, because she my father worked and she had to take care of a bistro. So they told me when my brother and my sister went to school, I was quite lonely for 2 years, the first 2 years, upstairs in my bed, and they let me get on with it.
And no TV, really.
So they prepared me for the manager's job at the time, certainly, no.
Well, it's very interesting in your book that there's almost a theme of loneliness that comes through at times, because you took some quite big jumps in your life. But you began playing football in your local village, and then you made your way through the ranks of football in Alsace, eventually yeah, finding your way to Strasbourg, who are a big club in League One. It's very striking now. You talk in the book about all the friends that you made at that time when you were coming through as a young man. It was obviously a period of your life that you enjoyed very much in your 20s.
Yes, it was. We were a golden generation because we were the first generation who had no war and we had no problem to find a job. You know, all my friends had good jobs. It was optimism and that was shared by everybody. It was the... at the time, the economy grew very quickly and there was no unemployment, basically. And that had certainly a repercussion on the optimism around. And it was a positive time. As well, I must say, we were still a generation where the parents told them, work hard. Don't talk too much. What counts is facts, is what you do, not what you say, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially in a village of agricultures, you cannot fool people, you know. They know quickly and all the families know each other. So it's quite a completely, I think in a village at that time, you had to a kind of authenticity. You were who you were, you know. Today in the city, you project yourself. You can pretend who you are. But at that time, it was more, you had to be real.
That's very interesting. Now, you became quite a good footballer in your teens, but I know that you've said that you didn't have anyone coaching you until you were 19. Do yes. you have some regret that you could have been a better player?
Regret, I could say yes, but on the other hand, I must say I must thank God, because when you have not a coach until the age of 19 and you make my career, you must say thank you very much. It's a miracle. And at that time in my village, football was not serious, you know. It's not serious enough to be a job. It's football is playing, it's not working. Mm-hmm. So... that's a kind of, nobody could imagine around us that you make a living out of a game.
But you made a living in Strasbourg, you started to learn how to coach, you made a big choice.
I was always well paid, very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Even in amateur level, we had the same salary than the professionals at the time, basically. I was maybe the best paid in Alsace, you know, and it was mixed. We were promotional, what is called, when I played in Mulhouse or after at Vauban. We had to declare our income, but we had I had the same income when the players basically in the top league.
So you're doing quite well. So you're really enjoying life. And you come into coaching, and then you move to Cannes. You go to the south coast.
Yes.
And you say in your book that it was like going to a different country.
It was, because Strasbourg is more German influence, more, and south of France was more Italian influence, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to rebuild the club, to build the club in Cannes with my friend Jean-Marc Guillou. And I must say, the first 6 months in Strasbourg, I was at home everywhere. Everybody knew me. And so, and suddenly to go to Cannes and to start it all again was the first time I left really my home.
You say in the book, living that isolated, solitary life where nothing was familiar was a revelation. I learnt that I could live anywhere with no interference and no personal affection. I was a solitary man who liked the solitude of decision-making. It's really quite striking how you turned being alone into a strength, into a virtue almost.
Yes, because I had the passion of the game, you know, and in Cannes I worked 8 hours a day on the pitch because I practiced with the first team and the academy. So I was very busy physically. When I came back late at night, I had only a sofa and football tapes. So it was a bit, I discovered that I could live without an environment that I knew. Where in Strasbourg, I knew everybody basically, and suddenly I was in an environment completely focused on football. I had friends as well in Cannes, but it was a life dedicated to work hard, you know.
So you developed a reputation in Cannes as a coach, and the opportunity came to take over at Nancy later on.
Yes.
Famously, the club.
And the opportunity in Monaco came as well from Cannes, because I got the reputation down there in the south of France, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Monaco came later.
I knew of you. You had 3 years in Nancy. This is the club of Platini. This is Michel Platini's club.
This is Michel Platini, yes.
And his father was still there when you were there, is that right? Running the place.
I worked with his father, yes, with Aldo. And he became a friend, of course, and I could have good football conversations with him, and it allowed me as well to watch a lot the national team, the French national team, because Michel played in the national team at the time. Sometimes in the summer he practiced with us in Nancy.
Mm-hmm. Had he gone on to Juventus by then?
He was at Juventus already when I was in Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
And because Juventus started later in the summer, and in France we started earlier with our training. Sometimes he asked me, what is your session? Running? I don't come. Playing? I come, you know. So sometimes he practiced with us.
He was the great player of his generation, wasn't he? A truly wonderful footballer.
He was an unbelievable player. Mm. People of the younger generations don't know him anymore, but it's the best vision I've seen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
On the football pitch.
The player who reminded me of Platini was Fabregas.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I always said that, you know. He reminds me a bit of Platini because his head is like that, moving around.
Constantly looking around, constantly like a bird almost.
Looking around, exactly. And Platini was like that. And so that they had that in common. But Platini was, let's not forget, a goal scorer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was three times on the trot, best goal scorer in Italy as a number 10.
Extraordinary player. And this was a time when they would only allow one foreign player. So he was, from an Arsenal point of view, he was the player who moved Liam Brady out of the Juventus team. And in a way, it was a terrible tragedy that the two of them couldn't play together.
Yes, of course. That would not be the case today.
No.
But as well, I've heard at that time, somebody from Arsenal came to watch him to play in Nancy, and he never attended the stadium.
Wow, that's disappointing.
You could have had both in England.
That would have been extraordinary. Now, Nancy was a difficult time, and you worked incredibly hard, but in the third year, they went down into the second division. You said in your book, only I could take responsibility for defeat, which was actually physically unbearable.
Yes. It still is, you know. But it's true, but we played only... When I arrived, we had good moments in Nancy, you know, some good moments, but in the last year, we had always to sell our best players, you know, and in the last year, we played only with youth team players. And overall, Nancy is where they are today, you know, they're struggling in the second league. The miracle was that we played in the top league. And for me, of course, it was difficult to take because not supporting defeat, you know, at Arsenal was lucky. You win 60% of a game approximately and you draw 20. Mm-hmm. And you lose about 20%, so it's one game out of five. But in Nancy, it was one game out of two, and sometimes two out of three. So that was a good preparation for my career.
So you were in pain for most of that season,
physically. Yes. Pain. I thought sometimes I'm not made to do this job. You know.
Did you not sleep?
Not much. But basically, physically, I couldn't take defeat.
Were you smoking heavily at that time?
I started to smoke, and the players smoked in France at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I started to smoke in Cannes with my friend Jean-Marc, who was he smoked 40 cigarettes a day. So I was never a heavy smoker, but I started to smoke, and you see pictures of me. Even in France at that time, smoking, you were not. Was normal. You
know? Normal in the changing room too?
Not in the changing room. I banned it in the changing room. But after the game, on the coach coming back, sometimes the players smoked. You didn't see each other.
A lot of smoke. So despite what happened in Nancy, despite the relegation, Nancy wanted you to stay.
Another
5-year contract. Another club came in for you as well, and
Paris Saint-Germain,
and Monaco came in.
And Monaco, yeah.
What was it? What were you doing that made you so in demand? What was it? Were you innovative? What was your reputation?
I don't know. I was the first surprised, you know. But at that time, it was not like it is today. Today, the manager is not alone with his team on the pitch. I was on my own with no assistant.
Mm-hmm.
No, nobody makes a session for you. It's you and the players. And I was a fitness coach, a goalkeeper coach, the assistant coach, main coach. And so I think it was a good education as well to prepare for the rest of my life. And I had the opportunities, you know. I had many clubs who wanted me, and Nancy wanted me to stay for 5 years, and I agreed at the start to stay for 5 years. But when Monaco came in and Paris Saint-Germain came in, I thought, if I turn that down now, it will be difficult to find that quality of club again, you know.
So in 87, you go to Monaco.
Yeah.
And you have this extraordinary first season where you win the championship.
Mm-hmm.
You have Glenn Hoddle in the team. You got him on a free transfer from Spurs. It's always nice to pinch a player from Spurs for
always.
Free. And you also had, am I right, that you had Mark Hatley in the team too?
Yes, yes.
Did Hoddle play high up the pitch as a 10, or did he play dropping in as a quarterback?
No, I played him high up the pitch. And I had two good suppliers behind him. And what happened as well, Glenn lost some weight. I thought he was not the quickest.
No.
And when he lost some weight, he suddenly became physically much stronger, you know. And then he became an extraordinary player. I thought, honestly, he has been voted, I think, a few years ago, player of the century in Monaco. And wow. we have seen some good players, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was unbelievable. Right foot, left foot, Platini vision.
Took all the free kicks.
Got the free kicks with right foot and left foot. And he could give his balls who just fall behind the defenders, you know.
And he had a way, didn't he, of stabbing exactly. at the bottom of the ball and spinning
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Amazing technician.
And it was an unbelievable perfectionist, Glenn Hoddle. Very demanding as well. A real football man, I must say.
And you say in the book that he used to read the Bible on the coach.
Yeah.
Quite an unusual personality.
He was religious at the time. I don't know if he still is, but he was very highly focused on that as well, yes.
Now, in your time at Monaco, you were... duking it out with Marseille, the rivals from along the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And Marseille were corrupt. Marseille were cheating. And it seems as though everybody knew they were cheating. And it's quite possible that you were denied maybe one or two more championships, do you think?
That's what people say today, yes. And but I cannot prove anything, so I don't talk about it, you know. But it was not a glamorous period of French football, and Marseille wasn't one. They had a great team, let's be mm-hmm. honest. Paris Saint-Germain had a great team. Bordeaux had a great team. And for us, you were a bit in a situation where England is today. You had four, five big clubs, you know, and it was difficult to fight with them. And in Monaco, you had less resources. But we had a good youth system. And when I arrived in Monaco, we never passed in the whole history one round in Europe, you know. And we started to be regularly present. We lost the final.
In 92, you lost the final. That was a very sad story in the book because the night before there'd been a stadium
yes,
tragedy.
A drama in Bastia. And we didn't want to play, and we lost the final against Bremen. And it was a bit similar to Arsenal against Barcelona because we didn't lose a game the whole season in the European Cup, and we just lost the final.
Just lost the final.
And
so
with
painful.
Arsenal, we didn't concede a goal in the whole knockout stage. And mm-hmm. we played big teams like Madrid, like Juventus, and Villarreal. And in the final, we played with 10 men.
Yeah, it was incredibly hard. So there was suspicion. What's extraordinary about that time in Marseille was that there was suspicion in other clubs' dressing rooms, wasn't there? Because you never knew if any players had been influenced by Marseille to drop their performance level.
Yes.
It's very difficult, the mistrust. In 1994, you had the opportunity while at Monaco to go and be the manager of Bayern Munich.
Yes.
And you decided not to take that chance. Was that a crazy moment? Should you have gone to Bayern? Franz Beckenbauer was there.
I should have gone.
Mm-hmm.
I should have gone because I arrived at the end after 7 years. I was the longest serving manager ever in Monaco, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to extend the contract. So I was torn between my Alsatian education. That means when you sign somewhere, you go to the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my realistic view was that, 7 years in Monaco is quite a long time. And I made the club climb a step higher up in Europe and be consistent at the top level. So maybe it's time to go.
And Bayern was one of the biggest jobs There was, and it was Trapattoni who took the job. He was a huge coach with Juventus. It was a great opportunity missed, and then suddenly you were shoved out the door anyway by Monaco.
Yes, in September. We had a bad start after the... it was 94. We had a bad start because after the World Cup, many players came back injured. We bought Sonny Anderson, who was injured, and we had a bad start. And the year before, it was the first time, I think, we didn't finish in the top three. And so we finished seventh in the league. So it was already, you know, people were not happy.
Yeah.
And but we played, we lost in a semi-final of a Champions League against Milan.
And that was a great Milan side.
Was the great Milan side. And so it, we had still a good season, but we didn't start well. And so the club knew I wouldn't extend. So they said, look, we stop here. We don't start well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And so you missed Bayern Munich and ended up instead on the other side of the world.
I missed Bayern Munich and I missed then Monaco as well.
So you end up in Japan. Do you take an 18-month tour of duty, as it were, in Japanese football? Again, a very bold move. You find yourself another language, another culture.
Yes.
You and Boro Primarac out there together.
You know, it summarizes a little bit what our job is about. It's basically a job for a single person because you need to go anywhere in the world at some stage, at any moment. And but on the other hand, it tests you. It forces you to understand people, to adapt to different cultures. And there's no better way to do that than to go to Japan when you're French.
Yes, I'm sure. And you found in Japan, you nearly came to Arsenal. George Graham had lost his job. Arsenal were looking for a manager. You knew David Dean by then, and you had a conversation. It seems they weren't quite ready to take a punt on Arsene Wenger in 1995, and it wasn't until 1996 that they came
tested
to you.
They tested the water. I had dinner in the favorite restaurant of Peter Hillwood at the time with Peter Hillwood and David Dean. And we talked about football, about, I think they wanted to see, David Dean knew me, but he wanted, of course, he needed to convince Peter Hillwood that I could be the man to do the job. And so I met Peter Hillwood and they went for Bruce Rioch.
Mm-hmm.
I was on my way to Japan, so I continued my way to Japan. And 1 year later, yes, they came in June or July 96 to offer me the job. We played an away game. And Danny Fisman, Peter Hillwood, and David Dean came to see me.
They all flew to Japan?
They all flew to Japan.
It was a fantastic moment for Arsenal. Rioch had done well. Rioch had an attacking vision of football. He signed Dennis Bergkamp. Wasn't quite the fit for Arsenal, but he left you a wonderful player, didn't he, in Dennis Bergkamp?
He left me a super wonderful player. And I think I was grateful for that, you know, and I don't know, he wasn't good. I just think... the opportunity was there for me, so I grabbed it.
He also left you a wonderful assistant in Pat Rice.
Yes. And I believe, you know, it is important when you go somewhere to different cultures that you have an assistant who knows the values of the club, the traditions of the club. And but with Pat Rice, I got not only that, I got more than that. You know, I got a guy with a great football knowledge, a huge fighter as well, and a guy who didn't want to project himself. What is very important as well when you're an assistant, but there is no struggle for that, you know, no fight for that. And I think Pat Rice is hugely intelligent and he did understand that.
And when you arrived, You took over on October the 1st, 96. Rioch had brought in three at the back, and we'd had for years and years at Arsenal so much success with the back four and David Seaman, and before that John Lukic. And now suddenly there was a three at the back. Sometimes he'd have Keown as a defensive midfielder. It felt like he was trying to find a way to get Bergkamp playing number 10. We had Hartson and Wright. We had Merson and Platt. We had good players, but perhaps not the... We couldn't get the balance of the team right. But you kept playing with three at the back, didn't you, for that whole of that first season?
Until the end of the season, yes, because I came on the 1st of October. I didn't want to disturb too much the system, you know, and I thought, let's see how that will work. They knew perfectly the system, you know, and it accommodated Steve Bold, Martin Keown, and Tony Adams. And on the flanks, we had Winterburn and Dixon. Mm-hmm. So these five, you could go to war with them, you know.
Yes.
But I came to the conclusion that if I wanted to win the league, I had to play with four. And at the end of the season, I decided, it was clear in my mind since February or March that... we will not beat Man United or Liverpool if we continue to play with the five, because all the back five were more defensive-minded players than offensive-minded players, you know. Mm-hmm. In a system like that, you need the wing-backs who are super offensive. But Nigel Winterburn, Lee Dixon were very clever players and very good players, but more defensive. Their strength was more defensive. So I thought, if you want to win the league, we have to move to a four.
That's very interesting. You also brought in, before you came, Patrick Vieira appeared.
Yes.
And he made his debut against Sheffield Wednesday. We're all season ticket holders here at the Tuesday Club. We all remember that debut so well. He came off the bench and immediately, apparently, was a magnificent midfield player who would receive the ball in any circumstances, marked by one, marked by two. He was able to turn, knock the ball past someone, two strides and he was gone. Suddenly we were able to play out from the back and through midfield in a way that we'd never seen before. Did you anticipate that he would have the impact that he had immediately?
I must say he's one of the few players who I saw the first time play with Cannes against Monaco. I was a coach in Monaco. Straight away, I said, this guy will be a great player. You know, and I must say, when I see the midfielders today, what I liked what you said about is that Patrick was one of his midfielders in any position turned the game forward, you know. Mm-hmm. And you don't find how many times, even last night I watched Germany, Switzerland, how many times did the midfielder play back to a defender when he could have turned the game forward?
Oh, it's the thing we hate the most. It's the thing we spend more time yelling forwards than anything else.
Exactly. And Patrick, not only had he that quality, he turned the game forward, even with two guys on his back. Because I remember sometimes, you know, Martin Keown had the ball and he turned Patrick down to give him the ball. Mm-hmm. And Patrick said, why don't you give me the ball? He said, but you're marked. Don't care about that. I will do it. Give me the ball. No matter if I have one or two players with me, give me the ball, you know. And so first of all, he wanted always the ball. Secondly, he didn't play back. He played forward.
And he never, ever hid. He never took up a position on the pitch where he looked like he was available, but in reality, you couldn't get the ball to him. Sometimes you see midfield players... Hiding with their arm in the air,
hiding, you know that, you know, and you know, the speed of availability of a midfielder is vital, and sometimes they hide a little bit, they all want the ball when you 2-0 up.
Another player, again, we mentioned him earlier, the player who we sit on the touchline on the west side, if there's a throw in on our side, the player who was always available, as if by magic, was Fabregas. Every time he was in space.
Always.
It was incredible. We called him God's chess piece, but it was as if he would be moved into space by God.
It is unbelievable, yes. And he had that straight away, you know.
He had that straight away. Yeah. But we'll get to him. Vieira to Bergkamp was the most common pass between one player and another in the entire Premier League in the 97-98 season. No one player passed to another more than Vieira passed to Bergkamp. You created a pathway through the team by utilising Vieira and by finding Bergkamp
I would say that's where, you know, football is less robotic than that, you know. A team goes naturally through its strong points. The way of a game goes natural to its strong points. So if a player like Patrick Vieira sees that Dennis Bergkamp is a timing of being available that counts. And so when Dennis had that intelligence to be available when he needed to be, and Patrick could see forward. So that's why I believe they found each other so well. The good players, you know, sometimes when I brought Pires in, for example, I give you, then I play a five-a-side. Then I put Pires, for example, in the team of Bergkamp. You have four teams of five players, you know. You put Pires in the team of Bergkamp. After 10 minutes, they played like they've played for life with each other, you know. And you feel straight away, we bought a good player. Because a good player, if a good player gives a ball to a good player, not to a bad player.
The same thing happened with Fabregas when he first came and he was 17. He and Bergkamp started playing together, like almost like father and son.
Exactly. The good player find each other.
Now, you put into that team, in 98, you put in Marc Overmars. We had a long history at Arsenal of right-footed left-wingers. Had some wonderful players.
Limpar
and George Armstrong and Brian Marwood just before. And now, and then this wonderful Dutch winger, this absolute flying Dutchman, plus the speed of Anelka and Ian Wright too. It was quite a fast-moving, dynamic team. Not so much a possession team, but a team that was explosive.
Yes, I wanted always explosive teams. And I thought that Marc Overmars had as well the timing of the movement of the ball, you know. Today, you develop more players who go bold, get ball to feet. And our evolution after was more ball to feet. But Marc Overmars was a guy, on the first 3 yards, it's like you threw him away. Couldn't stop him. Suddenly he was 5 meters in front of everybody. You didn't know why, but he was like, you throw him forward. And then you had players like Petit could give left-footed passes over the top.
Yes.
And Vieira, Bergkamp, of course. And I agree with you. We were speedy. We had Anelka, who was very quick.
Very fast.
We had Overmars, who was very fast. And then you had people who had the fast look, quick vision, you know.
But there's something about those strikers. Henri was the same. They have this knack of catching the eye of the midfielder. So the midfielder sees them. They don't necessarily need to scream for the ball, but they catch the eye. They make sure the midfielder's seen them. And then they almost trigger the pass. They make the midfielder play the pass.
Yes, because at the end of the day, football, to make it as simple as possible, you know, you have a quarterback and a runner. And you need one who can give the ball and one who can run for the ball and who can finish what you started. And once you have that and you do that in an intelligent way, it's very difficult to stop.
Now, it's well known that you changed the training. You brought more stretching in. You knew you had older players. You wanted to prolong them. And you changed their diet. They didn't get their Mars bars anymore. And and I remember playing, we played Everton in the last game that 98 season. We won 4-0. And towards the end of the game, you threw Steve Bould on as a substitute in central midfield. It was really something we'd never seen before, was Steve Bould patrolling the central midfield. And from that position, played one of the best through balls that we ever saw at Highbury.
Yes.
For Tony Adams. Did you find that moment as joyful and as almost hilarious as we did?
I found it both. You know, I think it's a. I always say that was for me the most satisfying win at Arsenal, because it's my first win and I could convince people that I can win a championship. But as well, it was a sunny day in May. You're crowned champion, and it is Thibault, the tradition scored the goal, you know. Mm-hmm. Bolt gives to Adams and Adams scores the goal. So it was something fantastic, and it was maybe one of the best moments of my career at the club.
A really amazing moment. And Bolt suddenly turned into Glenn Hoddle, and Adams went through. Then we go to Wembley, we win the final. I remember the huge anxiety that day, the idea that we could win the double again. We'd won it so many years before I was a fan. But a really amazing afternoon at Wembley and a fantastic start for you. So then we go to 98-99. Mm-hmm. And you talk about in the book being with David Dean and with one of David's daughters, Sasha, when you're doing a deal to sell Ian Wright to West Ham. Yes. And Sasha, when she realised what was happening, she tears came to her eyes.
Yes.
Wrighty was greatly loved. And then after that, he was struggled.
Ian Wright was the idol of Sasha. And by coincidence, she was there because we met the directors of West Ham. Ian Wright was at the table. So she was very happy at the start of the lunch because her adored player was having lunch with us. And slowly she realizes that, in fact, we are here to sell Ian Wright, you know.
And he was gone. It was a shock to many of us that you took that decision. I always wondered if you could have persuaded Wrighty to be a support striker, come off the bench, start less games. Did you think it was impossible to persuade him to do that?
Impossible. Ian Wright is an extrovert who had problems to deal with frustration. And the fact that I didn't play him in the FA Cup final never forgiven me, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he was determined to leave because he was not happy that, first of all, from a superstar at the club, suddenly he was not a regular player anymore. It's difficult to swallow that. And after, I thought I would have loved him to stay if he had accepted this role, because he was important in the team as well, you know. Everybody loved Ian Wright.
We loved him, but also we needed him that season because the players that we had, Kaba Diawara, Christopher Ray, Luis Boamorte, they were young players, not really familiar so much with the Premier League, and we just couldn't get the goals to back up. Yeah. Anelka, really. Kanu came later. And then you look at those early draws in that season. We found ourselves at the end of the season neck and neck with Manchester United when, frustratingly, we might have been ahead. But you were trying to get another striker. I remember at the time, Robbie Fowler.
I tried,
and
that's
linked.
Why I brought Kaba Diawara in. I remember the game, the decisive game where we lost the championship was at Leeds, you know. Mm-hmm. He had clear-cut chances that he missed. And if you had an Ian Wright there, yes, maybe he would have scored. But Kaba Diawara scored goals in France, and Christopher Ray scored sometimes goals, but were not completely to the level of Ian Wright, of course.
Yeah, it's very difficult. We drew 12 games. One of my colleagues on the Tuesday Club still hasn't forgiven Nelson Vivas for not marking Jimmy Floyd.
Yeah, but I haven't forgiven Haaland for kicking Winterburn on the head, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a tough game up there.
Tough game up there, and it's true that I had to bring Nelson Vivas on, and Hasselbank scored on the far post after.
So it was due to an injury to Winterburn for a nasty foul.
Very nasty foul.
That really hurt then, that season. A really, really painful. A painful semi-final, and United go on and win everything. And the feeling remained at Arsenal, that was our double there. It was taken from us somehow. And
That it is the penalty of Dennis Bergkamp, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And after that, he refused always to take the penalties.
Never took another pen.
Never took another pen.
And then the following season, we won't dwell on these painful moments. It's very noticeable in your book that we played so many cup finals when you were the manager. Every year you seemed to take us to a final. A final was quite a rare thing when I was growing up. And some of them went wrong. Some of them just didn't go the way we wanted them to, almost always by tiny margins. We played Galatasaray, lost on penalties. Excruciating evening where we had a chance from 2 yards out that Keown kicked straight up in the air. Then we had to go down their end, which was like a war zone, to take the penalties.
Exactly.
Hit the bar,
and the referee was not clear on that.
Did you feel that that was, I mean, really, the other end was a much more benign environment, wasn't
it? Yeah, but they said it's for security reasons we had to go up there.
That seems extraordinary.
Because they said that people could revolt if you don't go on their side.
Oh, really? And that had been...
After that final, the rule has been changed.
Is that right?
Yeah.
They thought if we don't have it...
The rule has been changed because after you take the toss, you know, to decide where you take the penalties.
But the referee thought if we don't have it at their end, they might riot. So we have to have it at their end.
Yes.
And there'd been trouble in Copenhagen. We managed to avoid it, my friends and I. We found a pizzeria and we had a very nice evening. But I remember seeing David Dean outside our hotel and there'd been an incident with a knife and he'd been to hospital with a fan. It was quite a difficult experience all around Copenhagen, 2000. Mm. I can understand perhaps why you left it out of the book.
I left it out of the book, yes, because I cannot talk about everything, you know.
No, of course. Let's move on. The following year, we had more disappointment. We lost to Liverpool in the cup final. I just want to ask you one question about that final. When Henri is through and Stefan Honcho is on the goal line and he tries to get the ball between Honcho and the near post, he goes for a nearly impossible finish. He achieves it, but Honcho, as a reflex really, knocks it away with his elbow like a goalkeeper. The referee seems to think the ball's hit the post and gives a goal kick. VAR gives us a red card and a penalty. Should Henri have squared to Wiltor?
Certainly, because you know it's always the same. If you don't score, you're wrong. So he had a solution available that was certainly more secure, and that's what he should have done.
I felt like when I see Henri's face after that moment, he's not really appealing for the penalty. He's got a look on his face. He was a young man still then, that tells you that he knows he's in the wrong, that he should have passed to his friend.
Yeah, certainly, because Thierry Henry knew everything what was going on a football pitch, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, the following year, that summer, after that disappointment, you pulled off the great transfer coup of our time. You persuaded Sol Campbell to leave Spurs, and Arsenal had all these ageing centre-backs, club legends, one and all, but we needed somebody young and strong to come in and take over at the back. You put Sol Campbell in there. We also had Robert Pires, who'd had a difficult first season, but it was clearly immensely talented, if a little bit slight and perhaps vulnerable to... He learned how to win free kicks rather than injuries, didn't he?
Yeah.
And that team was extraordinary. Was that... Do you think that was the best team in terms of just a one-off game?
Yes, I would say yes. If you think today, you had a good player in every single position, you know?
Yes.
And that's where you achieve the quality. And overall, I would say we had the physical quality, we had the technical quality, we had the creativity. We had a good mixture of all the needed qualities you need in a team.
They were a fantastic team. Most of them stayed around for another season or two and went on to become the Invincibles. Do you lie awake at night remembering the Invincibles?
I look at it and I think when you go through such a golden period, you know, where you don't lose for 1.5 years, a Premier League game, it's difficult to imagine now. The only regret I have is I didn't enjoy it enough, you know. I enjoyed it at the time, but I still think today I should have enjoyed it even more, because suddenly the fear to lose disappears. And you just go to the game and think, if we turn up, we will win the game. And that's why I thought that Invincible year was something, with 49 games basically as a whole, was something amazing, because you wonder, why am I paid to do this job? Because it's so easy. And your team owns the way you want to play. They drive for perfection. They refuse to be average. They want excellence. They're demanding with each other, you know. And it's an amazing period of my life.
Things began to change, I think, in 2005. Football began to change. 4-4-2, which had been Arsenal's way and Manchester United's way, went a bit out of fashion. And lots of teams in the league at that time were playing five in midfield. It felt that even Patrick Vieira, with all his power, could get swamped in midfield. Mm. And the fashion began to, in the Champions League, to play a more short-passing possession game. Did you really make a conscious decision to move away from the real powerhouse midfield of Parla, Vieira, Edu, to a more technical...
Not conscious, no. I just looked for good midfielders. And after, when I took Fabregas to play in a 4-4-2 central defensively midfield, he was not his strength, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had to put one more midfielder in to give him a chance to survive. That's why when you played in the Champions League, it's true what you say, is that the teams went, you had the feeling that if you didn't dominate the midfield, you had no chance in the Champions League. And I went then for one more midfielder. Because before you had the powerhouses like Vieira, Petit, you know, they could do the defensive job. After when you have Fabregas, we needed a bit to strengthen a bit the midfield.
So I want to fast forward you to the San Siro in 2008 when Arsenal won 2-0. AC Milan were the reigning European champions. I don't think at that time that any English team had won away at AC Milan.
No.
I was in the away end, high up in the away end behind Perspex screen. At the end of that game, Arsenal won 2-0. The Milan fans that remained gave Arsenal a standing ovation. It was a standing ovation all around the ground. All the fans in front of us who'd been giving us all kinds of abuse throughout the game turned and applauded us. It was a really remarkable performance. Diaby played on the left because Rosicki had been injured. We had Alexander Chleb, who was a brilliant technician. Did you think that team could have been something really special?
I think, yes, we had... I said that in my book as well, you know. Arsenal today, the dominance of the Arsenal period is until 2006 in the mind of people. But after, we played some fantastic football and we couldn't finish a job sometimes in Europe and after in the league as well, because we finished, I think, two times second after that. And... with less resources, we still played, I think, football with top quality, and we had top quality games in Europe as well. We won in Madrid in 2006, but after we won in Milan against AC Milan, against Inter Milan, we had some fantastic wins, but it's not in the memories anymore because it's not crowned by titles.
Well, that game is certainly in my memory. Also in my memory from 2008 were the terrible injuries that we had. We lost Van Persie, we lost Rosicki in January, and then we lost Eduardo. Do you think you should have signed Anelka from Bolton?
Maybe. He wanted to come back. Maybe it was a mistake. I wanted always to give a signal to the players that once you leave the club, there's no way back. Because I felt that they would then have an hesitation to leave, you know. So I didn't give them the feeling, okay, I go somewhere else. If I do, it doesn't work, I come back. And so that's why I didn't do it. And overall, maybe I should have done it. And Niklas were still scored 125 games in the Premier League, I think, something like that, you know, so it could have helped us.
And yeah, you had great, as you say, great matches. We beat Barcelona in 2011. We had disappointments in some games, but let's finish up, Arsene, by talking about those last few years when you signed Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez, and we had the chance to win the league, didn't we, in 2016? Perhaps we should have done. We won those FA Cups. Did it give you more pleasure in a way to return to winning ways, to return to trophies than it had at the beginning? It had been a long, hard road paying back the stadium.
Yes, I think people after a while say, OK, you're in the top four, but you don't win the European Cup and you don't win trophies anymore. So I thought the fact that you could come back and to win the FA Cup 14, 15, 17, you know, and we had good teams and we could have won the championship in 2016. We finished second in the league. Personally, I think that year, Tottenham had a good opportunity to win the league.
They did, and it was great that they didn't.
Yes.
There was one game, Arsene, that year. At the end of 2015, we had more points than anyone else in the calendar year. We beat Manchester City. We were the cup holders. We had Ozil, we had Sanchez, we had a terrific team. And then we lost 4-0 to Southampton on Boxing Day.
Yeah.
And we had a capacity in those days for a heavy defeat, for the wind to blow the wrong way. What was it? Why did that happen?
We were more vulnerable defensively, you know. I remember that day, Mertesacker had a bad day. And we realised today that Southampton had a good team. The guy who killed us on the day was Mane.
Right. He'd have been a good signing.
He could have been a good signing. You know, we should have signed him when he was in Metz, when he played the Olympic Games with Senegal in London. That's where we should have signed him. And that's why I think they had Lallana, they had Mane, they had fantastic players, Southampton. And I think we had a good win on the 23rd of December at home in a difficult game.
Yeah, Man City.
Man City, and we went to Southampton and we collapsed because we're physically a bit jaded maybe, and as well Wojciech, I think, played. Chesney had a bad day on the day. We conceded some bad goals.
I won't go. I don't want to finish for you on a painful on a painful memory.
Well, still, you know, it's amazing when I talk about it, the pain comes out again and the memories come out up again.
They really do. And you talked to them right at the beginning about your father keeping his pain and his secrets right inside, and the feeling that the people around you when you were a boy kept their pain inside. And there's a feeling I have with you that that is a habit that you've carried your whole life.
Yes, it's true.
You don't let it out in your book. I feel bad to bring it to you now.
Let's finish on
that amazing final when Alexis Sanchez was wonderful against Chelsea. Was that a real joy to see, to win that match in that 2017?
That was fantastic because let's not forget that we played Man City in the semi-final. And then Man City was a great side, you know, we're better than today. And we played Chelsea, we were champions. And once a team has won the championship, they go in the cup final.
Yeah, they were going for the double.
They're going for the double. It's very difficult to stop, you know. And the fact for me, it's one of the great victories of Arsenal during my stay. And it was a bit... Football is sometimes special, because you think it is... on the day, we had all the problems at the back. Mertesacker had not played one game.
That's right.
In the whole season. He played one game. It was a final of a cup against the best team in the country.
It was extraordinary against Costa.
And it was extraordinary, you know. And we had Holding, I think, as well played.
The artist boy.
And so that was absolutely fantastic. It was a fantastic day. One of my happiest days at the club.
It was a great day. One of many FA Cup wins. Arsene, I think I would love to sit here and talk to you all day long about Arsenal, and there are so many other things.
Yeah, I think you know more about Arsenal than I do.
I'm an obsessive, about when Arsenal's concerned. But the contribution that you made, the work, the hard work for so many years that you put into our club, is hugely appreciated. Never underestimate our gratitude. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. All the success for the season.
Good luck with your book, which I think is going to be a big seller.
I don't know, but I just wanted to give an honest, short experience of my special period of my life.
Well, you've certainly achieved that, and good luck with your continued work with FIFA.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.